This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We begin this week with a look at some big legal cliffhangers before the U.S. Supreme Court. And before the end of the month, we could be seeing some big changes in voting rights, the federal concept of marriage, patentable genes, affirmative action. We will also note the passing of a political legend in the state of New Jersey, Senator Frank Lautenberg. Some Silicon Valley writers are going to push back on accusations that techies don't do politics very well. Some racially insensitive pushback that we'll note on a Cheerios advertisement featuring a biracial family. We'll have a biracial daughter weigh in on whether Cheerios are actually good for us. And a critical view of Bono. You loved him as the frontman for the legendary band U2. Do you love him as much as the frontman for some billionaire philanthropists and former presidents? That's later this hour. But first, tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in Turkey. More than 1,700 people have been arrested. Protests began over Prime Minister Erdogan's plans to build a shopping mall on Istanbul's Taksim Park. It grew into a more comprehensive rejection of what demonstrators now say is the prime minister's seemingly dictatorial ambitions. With us is Asla Aydıntaşbaş, columnist for the Turkish daily Milliyet, which focuses on Turkish politics and the Middle East. Welcome.
Hi.
What would you say is driving these protests right now? The scale of them seems to have surprised the government, the popularly elected government of Prime Minister Erdogan.
Certainly, Erdogan is a popularly elected prime minister, and by all means, he's the most popular politician in the country. But he also happens to be a divisive figure. There's a lot of anger on the street. The prime minister does tend to have a bit of a rough style, and he also tends to, the government, the way the government works is increasingly centralized decision-making mechanism. In other words, Erdogan is asking people to have three kids at least. He's just recently passed a new ban on alcohol. He's a conservative man, conservative Muslim, and he does tend to preach about conservative values and lifestyle. And on top, he's a micromanager. He basically makes decisions about every aspect of Turkey's infrastructure or government policies or, you know, city planning, you name it. The trigger was a park at the central square of Istanbul, Taksim Square. It's called Gezi Park. The prime minister said it would turn into a shopping mall. He's been basically, he is the mayor of Istanbul, although there is a mayor. Erdogan makes the top decisions. But, you know, it's also about his desire for an overhaul of the whole system, switching from a parliamentary system to a presidential system. And there's a lot of resentment about that. So all in all, this is about the prime minister, I think.
We're talking with Asla Aydıntaşbaş, who's a columnist for the Turkish daily Milliyet, which focuses on Turkish politics and the Middle East. You know, this reminds me in some ways, and I'll give you a quote here of his reaction to some of these protests. "We would not yield to a few looters coming to that square and provoking our people, our nation, based on their misinformation," a statement which really suggests that these protesters are completely illegitimate. This feels a little bit like the kind of overreach that was associated with the Shah of Iran, who's in the midst of prosperity, really stepped on so many levels of society that in the end, he didn't have a lot of friends when the revolution came. Not to say that there's revolution brewing in Turkey.
Well, it is early to say, and I wouldn't exactly call it a revolution. And I think the similarities to Tahrir Square at this point are rather somewhat superficial. But God, Erdogan's statements are angering people, have angered people. Even today, when he was leaving at a press conference he held at the airport, he talked about the entire thing as something fomented by foreign powers. And that's really old Middle East, old rhetoric. I think the prime minister, from where he stands, is, I've done so much for these people. I'm the father of this country. I'm planning roads and I'm working so hard. Why are they angry? The problem is people want to say, yes, he's a very effective leader, but people do want to have a say in how their cities govern, how they lead their lives and whatnot. I think that similarities to Shah are not right on insofar as Iran was not a democracy. In many ways, Turkey is a better functioning democracy than anywhere in the Middle East. The problem is the prime minister thinks democracy only takes place once in 4 years when you go to the ballot. The truth is, you can also have demonstrations, and that's part of democracy as well.
So do you think it would be smarter for him to simply tolerate this dissent rather than try to crack down so sort of stridently on it and just allow things to run their course?
I think it would have been much better to just come out and say, I got the message, or we got the message, or we're going to think about it, or even not speak. But yesterday he was on the air. He gave an interview to a friendly news organization, which seems to be most of Turkish news outlets these days. And basically he said those who drink are alcoholics. And he also really looked down on people that are protesting. He's not really asking why they're angry. He's just saying they are from the main opposition party or encouraged by foreign powers. I don't think that's the spirit. I think that he's not able to empathize. There's a lot of sports fans as well, ultras of some soccer teams in the city. And the prime minister sees it as a threat to his power. All he had to say was, we might back down on these plans. Instead, he's really determined to go ahead and build a new structure at the park. He's back down on the idea of a shopping mall, but says it will be a hotel or maybe a city museum. But he went on to say that he was also going to build a mosque at the same square. So, you know, don't introduce anything new and just say, I'm listening. That's all that's needed.
Is this a challenge to secularists and liberals, or is this a challenge to just anyone who's not him?
I think the people that are out there demonstrating are largely non-AKP voters. That includes secularists, that includes nationalists, that includes some Kurds, and people who have not voted for Erdogan. But that's not to say that people who have voted for him are happy with his management style, with his the way he's managed this affair, nor are they happy with the idea of building a shopping mall. Islamists have traditionally looked down on greed and commercialization of every aspect of our lives. And I think that the idea of tearing down a park in order to build a mall is not really appealing to anybody, let alone the fact that this is essentially one man's decision.
Asla Aydın Taşbaş is a columnist for the Turkish daily Milliyet. She spoke with us from Istanbul. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
It's the end of an era for the state of New Jersey in politics. Also, the passing of one of the lions of Democratic Party politics in the U.S. Congress. Frank Lautenberg, five-term U.S. senator, died early this morning at the age of 89. The oldest serving senator, Lautenberg had struggled with cancer since a diagnosis in 2010. He's the last World War II veteran to serve in the U.S. Senate. There are only two World War veterans left in the House of Representatives. Joining us now is Bob Henley, political reporter for public radio station WBGO in Newark. Also with us, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, John.
So, Bob, what does Lautenberg's legacy mean for the state of New Jersey?
Well, he was really a self-made individual, born in Paterson, rose up, you know, basically working class, made a fortune. He's had three acts, John. The automatic data processing that he founded transformed. You know, if you get a paycheck today that's automated, it's thanks to the technology and processing that Lautenberg's company really were the leaders in. Then he got elected in 1982 because of Harrison Williams, a Democratic senator, ran into trouble with Abscam, and he had to resign. So under a special election, Lautenberg stepped in and saved the day. And then again, and he retired and stepped out. And then in 2002, he came back in again, John, when Democratic Senator Torricelli had to drop out from his reelection bid over an ethical cloud. So once again, this line in winter came to the rescue of the Democratic Party.
A very ironic trajectory for Frank Lautenberg. But in the Congress, Todd Zwillick, there's a real body of law that's associated with his advocacy.
Yeah, Frank Lautenberg over five terms, John, a reliable liberal vote, one of the most reliable liberal votes in the Senate. Look, there's a couple things in your everyday life that are thanks to Frank Lautenberg. You can't smoke on an airplane because of legislation that Frank Lautenberg got passed in 1987. The drinking age is 21 nationwide because of Frank Lautenberg. He was always a major advocate for liberal causes in the background of the Senate, a good speechifier, and had the respect. I have to say, there are statements coming this morning from all wings of the party. It is not just just the liberals who are praising Frank Lautenberg this morning. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and other Republicans, and John Flaggs are already at half staff across the Capitol complex on news of Frank Lautenberg's death.
Bob Henley, this was a man who had a real sense of public service. He didn't have to come back after Torricelli dropped out. He didn't have to come into the U.S. Senate again, but he did.
Well, it was said that he actually regretted the decision to retire. And I think the critical thing about Lautenberg is he was that link to a conviviality that once existed down in Washington, a kind of mutual respect. And again, because he came up through the working class, you know, his father died prematurely from cancer. So for Frank Lautenberg, the real problems in New Jersey, so for him, it was personal.
And Todd Zwillick, with so many lawmakers, leaving, retiring, because they find the Senate particularly and the House in general to be a place where you can't get anything done, Lautenberg seemed to just love it right up until the end.
His last vote cast, John, as he was ailing a couple of months ago, was right where it should have been for Frank Lautenberg, given his longtime advocacy for gun control. It was on the background checks legislation that so famously failed on the Senate last month. Frank Lautenberg came back to Washington, came onto the Senate floor in a wheelchair, and voted on that legislation to applause from many of his colleagues, even those who voted against him. So there is a legacy there. And John, not only his World War II service, Frank Lautenberg has another little piece of American legacy that most people don't know about. His foundation, the Frank Lautenberg Foundation, was a victim of the Bernie Madoff scheme and lost millions and has been involved in lawsuits against the Madoff estate ever since. Most people don't know that of all the victims across the Madoff panoply there, Lautenberg was one of them.
So Bob Henley and Todd Zwillick, both of you can make a comment on this. I suspect the political forces in New Jersey now will be thinking about a replacement for Frank Lautenberg. How does that stand, and how is that likely to shake things up in Washington? Bob, you first.
Yeah, it comes down to Governor Christie has to make a choice. Of course, a very close confidant of his, Senator, State Senator Joe Crills from Monmouth County, made an unsuccessful run against Senator Menendez. The Washington Post is reporting that there will be a special election. And then, of course, if that's the case, then you have to have really deep pockets, because in 2014 you've got to be ready to do that. This is going to also send a signal about Chris Christie, because he's trying to thread this needle. He's running in a re-election year. He's got to succeed in a blue state to prevail as governor for a second term, and at the same time he's got his eye on 2016. So you can imagine the choice, even for this interim spot, is going to be really looked at closely.
Presidential politics, a lot of filters with which to look at this Lautenberg successor issue. Yes, Todd?
Chris Christie, Bob Henley's exactly right. Chris Christie has to think Tea Party 2016, people who loved him in the last election, but New Jersey's not a real Tea Party state. Does he appoint a senator in the special who satisfies sort of the light blue politics of New Jersey, or really try to make a nod to the conservatives of his wing, looking forward to the possibility of a 2016 run? That's the real politic of the decision here for Chris Christie.
All that for later in the week today, remembering Frank Lautenberg, five-term Democratic U.S. Senator from the state of New Jersey, who's died at the age of 89. Bob and Todd, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and Bob Henley, political reporter for WBGO in Newark. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a narrow 5-4 decision, says it's okay for police to take DNA samples from you at the time of arrest, along with fingerprints and photographs, so-called mugshots. 28 states and the federal government allow the DNA sampling. The court says the taking of DNA does not constitute a warrantless search that violates privacy rights. It was an unusual division of labor for the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Roberts, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas, joined by swing Justice Anthony Kennedy and liberal Justice Stephen Breyer, were the majority, while conservative Antonin Scalia was in the minority with liberal justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. Interesting case, perhaps even more interesting split, which may deliver some clues about the remaining cases this term. Before the end of the month, we want to remind you, major decisions are expected on affirmative action, voting rights, gene patenting, and at least two separate cases on same-sex marriage. We turn now to Jeffrey Rosen, as we often do, professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Professor, welcome.
Great to be here.
What do you make of that split? Scalia, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Sotomayor. I haven't seen that one before.
Fascinating split, fascinating case. Justice Breyer often sides with the conservatives in criminal procedure cases. And here he cast the tie-breaking vote to uphold the collection of DNA in a way that, as you said, is narrow given the facts of this case and this particular law, but could have really big implications for privacy down the line. Justice Scalia proving himself once again to be a civil libertarian in Fourth Amendment cases where he thinks that the framers of the Constitution would have required a warrant for what he believes are clearly searches, and wrote a passionate dissent saying that this is the first time the court has upheld, without a warrant, a search whose primary purpose is ordinary criminal law enforcement.
Well, Justice Breyer, as you say, was the swing vote in this particular case. We're used to thinking of Justice Kennedy as the swing vote. And in the upcoming affirmative action case, University of Texas versus Holder, during arguments, Justice Kennedy sounded like he indeed was going to be the swing vote. Listen.
You argue that the university's race-conscious admission plan is not necessary to achieve a diverse student body because it admits so few people, so few minorities. And I had trouble with that reading the brief. I said, well, if it's so few, then what's the problem?
Of course, that was the argument of University of Texas versus Fisher, but it was still the affirmative action case. Does Kennedy sound like he's going to be the swing vote in this particular one?
He does. And Kennedy is very interesting in affirmative action cases. He's come up to the edge of declaring affirmative action impermissible because he really believes the Constitution is colorblind. An individual should not be classified on the basis of race. But then he's taken care to say, I'm not saying never, and saying that universities and public schools may be able to use race consciousness as long as they've exhausted every other alternative. So in this oral argument, he was clearly troubled by the fact that, as he put it, this plan didn't create that many minority students. He seems likely, many people think, to strike down this Texas plan, which first admits the top 10% of students from every Texas high school, and then in addition engages in some race-conscious affirmative action. But it's possible that he won't say all affirmative action is impermissible, although he's unlikely to give us a very clear sense of what exactly universities can do down the line.
Let's move to the voting rights case. That's Shelby County versus Holder. And in this particular case, I want to play two clips from the arguments, one from Sonia Sotomayor and the other from Justice Breyer. It sounds to me like the liberals are looking for a way to affirm the voting rights case here. They may end up still being in the minority, but here's Justice Sotomayor first.
Assuming I accept your premise, and there's some question about that, that some portions of the South have changed, your county pretty much hasn't.
It's an old disease. It's gotten a lot better, but it's still there. So if you had a remedy that really helped it work, but it wasn't totally over, wouldn't you keep that remedy?
So here we have Justices Breyer and Sotomayor talking about the sort of time machine elements of the Voting Rights Act put in place to deal with discrimination that is historically in a place like Shelby County. The question is, has the county come into the 21st century enough for the Voting Rights Act to go away? What do you think?
That's exactly the question. And the conservative justices are clearly impatient with the fact that a few years ago, they gave a strong signal to Congress that they believe that the Voting Rights Act should be reexamined and its formulas tightened up, and Congress didn't act. The liberal justices felt a similar frustration. Justice Sotomayor in the argument was saying, well, if there's any county that shouldn't be here, it's Shelby County, because evidence of discrimination is so extreme. She acknowledged that other counties and states might be in a different position, but the betting is that there's a decent chance that there may be five votes to significantly restrict, if not strike down, the portions of the Voting Rights Act that require federal oversight of racially motivated changes in voting arrangements. And that could would just be a huge shift in voting law.
The gene patenting case is all about the future, and we'll just sort of brush over that for a moment in the sense that the justices are really trying to determine if you can patent genes in the same ways that you patent drugs if they have some sort of naturally occurring ingredients. That's a case that's going to come down this month. But let's end on Justice Scalia, who's commenting here in the oral arguments on the case regarding Proposition 8 in California. This is one of two same-sex marriage cases, and here's Justice Scalia.
When did it become unconstitutional to exclude homosexual couples from marriage? 1791? 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted?
You know, I may agree or disagree with Justice Scalia, but I'm fascinated by that question.
It is a fascinating question. And the answer of Ted Olson was equally fascinating. He said, Justice Scalia, when did it become unconstitutional to ban interracial marriage, which the Supreme Court struck down in the 1960s? So that exchange was really illuminating, as was the debate between Scalia and counsel on the other side about whether or not states' rights required protecting gay marriage or allowing states to ban it. Scalia seemed to suggest that it should be up to the democratic process, but the challengers of the Defense of Marriage Act flipped that and said that actually it was a violation of states' rights for the federal government to treat marriage equality differently based on whether or not gays and lesbians were getting married or straight people. So the hope for the challengers is that Justice Kennedy, who cares a lot about states' rights arguments, will agree that the Defense of Marriage Act is a violation of states' rights and strike it down, while at the same time hold that California, having granted the right to gay marriage, can't take it away.
Lots of very big issues to be resolved between now and the end of the month. We'll all be watching. So will Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. Thanks so much, Professor.
It's a pleasure, as always.
This is The Takeaway. The breakfast cereal Cheerios is enriched with 14 vitamins and minerals. Did you know that? It's a good source of calcium, an excellent source of iron, can help lower cholesterol. And some boxes also contain some cultural nutrition as well.
Mom. Yes, honey?
Dad told me that Cheerios is good for your heart. Is that true?
That's a Cheerios commercial that has been viewed on YouTube 1.7 million times, depicting a biracial young girl, her white mother, and black father. The ad has produced racist backlash and then an even bigger supportive backlash to the backlash. General Mills has suspended the comment section on its YouTube site and fully supports the ad, which it says will continue to run. Joining us now is Megan Hatcher Mays, who's been inspired by all of this. She's a contributor to Jezebel and grew up in a biracial family. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So would you have ever thought that a Cheerios ad would be so meaningful in your own life?
No. In short, no. But somehow here we are, and it is meaningful to me. And I know it's meaningful to a lot of friends of mine who are biracial or multiracial as well. It's just really exciting to see families that look like mine finally being reflected in popular culture.
What do you make of the pushback and the extent to which General Mills even might have been surprised by the extent to which people still register disapproval for something that's gone on for generations?
Yeah, you know, I guess it would be nice if I could say, oh, I'm so surprised that people in 2013 are racist. But, you know, I mean, that's one of my least favorite reactions is, oh, but it's 2013 and Barack Obama is president. And, you know, it would have been great if we had woken up in November of 2008 and racism had ended. But that's not what happened. So the response to the ad, the racist response to the ad has been almost welcome by me because it starts to bring to the surface some of these attitudes that we thought were dead and gone, and they're not. They exist and they're real, and lots of people still face overt and covert racism all the time. So to the extent that this commercial has provided a starting point for some sort of dialogue, I actually really appreciate it.
Well, I certainly would concede the racist kind of bias in, you know, generations of all white families on cereal boxes. I mean, I think the extent to which people were deluded into thinking that America is some, you know, white utopia was racist and absurd. But distinguish, I'm trying to sort of grasp here between, you know, really awful, nasty people who need almost no excuse to weigh in a hateful way, and a general sense of whether the United States is more tolerant of multiracial families these days than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago.
You're right. There's people who are just perfectly willing to be overtly racist and be awful. You know, they don't need an invitation to be awful
right.
on the internet. But, you know, we feel like things are a lot more tolerant because we can sort of move freely through society without being victims of overt racism. You know, we still have people like the white dad in Virginia in the parking lot of Walmart who was suspected of kidnapping his own kids just because they're biracial. So, I mean, still a prejudice and still a bias. And just because that they operate more covertly doesn't mean they're not just as damaging. And all sorts of people grow up experiencing stuff like this. People asking their moms if their mom is really their mother, like if they're actually related. You know, in my mom's case, you know, my brother was born really fair-skinned, blonde, blue eyes. You know, my mom is black. And people would ask my mother, oh, are you a nanny? Or what do you charge? You know, stuff like that. And so I think what this Cheerios commercial does is provide some visibility for non-traditional looking families. And I think that's really, really important.
Well, it's nice to know that there's possibly some socially relevant nutrition in Cheerios along with all the rest of the vitamins, right?
Yes, it's really good to know. And, you know, biracial people, multiracial people, you know, we eat breakfast too. So it's important to know that someone's looking out for our cholesterol.
Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Hatcher-Mays is a contributor to Jezebel. You would think that the man who co-wrote the movie Toy Story, gave us Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the screen version of The Avengers, would have a well-developed sense of whimsy and an ability to poke fun at himself.
You are an ass! You are an ass.
That she were here to write me down an ass. But, Masters, remember that I am an ass, though it be not written down yet. Forget not that I am an ass.
That's a scene from the latest film from Joss Whedon, who has decided to try his hand at the high-end whimsy of low-end Shakespeare. Much Ado About Nothing. When The Takeaway's Kristen Meinzer sat down with Joss last week and asked why Much Ado, she got a very whimsical Joss Whedon answer.
I think of it as kind of a gateway drug for Shakespeare, for a lot of people who don't know the plays or think of them as sort of stately. This is really sort of casual and lovely and intense and funny, and I think that it just hits on a lot of levels.
And why did you choose to shoot it all in modern times and all in black and white?
I really looked into the depths of my heart as an artist and said, I have no money. So it was never an issue. I also really like the modern dress Shakespeare when it's not very pointed, when it's just done because you want to say, look, it still applies. The movie came out of the readings we used to do at my house where nobody dressed up except once when Tom Plotkin played Malvolio and did wear bright yellow socks. That was it. That's the amount of special effects or costuming we ever had. And so that casual kind of very lived in, very sort of, you know, nonchalant attitude towards the text while still respecting it and really enjoying the drama of it was sort of something I wanted to convey. And modern dress is another way to do that, to bring the audience in.
Just some logistical things about shooting this movie. You did it in only 12 days. You did it in your house and you were saying you were on a tight budget. There's a lot of potential for stuff to go terribly, terribly wrong under those circumstances. Did anything bad happen while you were filming this?
We had a couple of incidents. I mean, rolling sound outside in your own home makes you realize that your neighbors are the loudest people alive and that all they do is mow and leaf blow. And they all have yappy dogs. And the house next door actually did start demoing 3 days before we started shooting, and we live fairly near the Santa Monica Airport. All these things I realized when we shot. That was a bit of a problem. And then we did lose a couple of shots just in the files. You know, it was all digital. We shot with the Red Epics, and everything was, you know, being transferred digitally. And right when we were about to finish, they said, we need to get a couple of shots that disappeared. But apart from that, we actually had enormous skill, I'm not going to lie. We had great luck. We had particular luck with the weather, like weird luck with the weather, where it was perfectly matchingly cloudless and the right temperature for the entire shoot till we got to the funeral scene and the fog rolled in.
Ooh, perfect.
Yeah, we were like, quick, everybody get ready. Get those cameras. Look at that fog. Get by that fog.
And you were making all of this around the same time you were doing The Avengers, which is a very different setup. You have a $200 million movie. You have special effects. You have big Hollywood behind it. And this is a very different thing. This is in your house. Was Much Ado About Nothing in some way a reaction to making The Avengers?
In some ways it was. You know, The Avengers was a grueling shoot. And I was at the very end of it. And Kai, my wife, said, yeah, you know, this has been really hard on you. And I think, you know, we've been planning a vacation for a long time. I had 1 week off. And she said, you really need to just relax. So you should make another movie. And
like, that's relaxing.
Oh, yeah. No, I was like, that sounds great. But I can't possibly adapt this and cast it and prep it in a month. And she was just like, like any great producer, she was like, "Oh really? Oh really? Can't do it? Really? You're gonna cry? Baby gonna cry?" And how she knew that that's what I needed, I still find it extraordinary.
Joss Whedon is the director, writer, and producer of The Avengers, Cabin in the Woods, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, his newest film, Much Ado About Nothing, hits theaters on Friday. And if you follow The Takeaway on SoundCloud, you can hear Kristen's full-length interview with Joss. We asked you if you had a favorite line of Shakespeare. Many of you, it turns out, do. People love the line, out damned spot. And continuing that thought, Michael in Seattle loves this line. Will all great Neptune's oceans wash this blood clean from my hands? Give us a call. Tell us your favorite line of Shakespeare. Recite it for us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We have two looks now at possibly misguided attempts to throw one's weight around. In a moment, Bono and the billionaires. But first, a look at Silicon Valley. Shortly before his death, Apple founder Steve Jobs weighed into politics at the Cupertino City Council meeting in June of 2011.
As you know, we're the largest taxpayer in Cupertino, so we'd like to continue to stay here and pay taxes. That's number one.
At one point during the meeting, Jobs was asked if Apple would give the people of Cupertino free Wi-Fi.
See, I'm a simpleton. I've always had this view that we pay taxes and the city should do those things. That's why we pay taxes. Now, if we can get out of paying taxes, I'll be glad to put up Wi-Fi.
Just a billionaire simpleton, Steve Jobs there. But for one of the highest valuation companies in the world to be talking about property taxes in the hometown of Cupertino perhaps symbolizes both the folksy style and legendary political cluelessness of Silicon Valley's moguls. In his most recent New Yorker article, author George Packer notes that the tech oasis can feel more like a political bubble, where a knee-jerk libertarianism passes for sophisticated political philosophy. Well, Packer's New Yorker profile has produced a lot of comment in the Valley, pushback and soul-searching for techies all over the world. Hamish McKenzie is a reporter for Pando Daily, the self-described site of record for Silicon Valley, says the Valley is misunderstood. He joins us now. Hamish, welcome.
Thanks, and nice to be here.
You know, Packer's, I was at a tech conference down in Mexico City, and Packer's article had attracted a lot of attention among techies in Latin America as well. What do you make of Packer's premise, and how would you push back?
Oh, I don't think it's a terrible premise. I think there's some truth to it, but it oversimplifies in general what's going on in Silicon Valley and what's going on in the tech industry.
Do you think there are consequences to this that Packer said, that Apple apparently has plans to spend $5 billion to build what Packer calls an impenetrable ringed headquarters in the middle of a park, inward-looking places that keep tech workers from having even accidental contact with the surrounding community? Does that create an architectural bubble that then has political consequences?
Possibly. I do think there is some level of separation in the Valley that is potentially not healthy for society, but that's also quite an easy criticism to make. I just think that the issue is a little bit more complicated.
What do you make of the attempts by Mark Zuckerberg, who has described on various occasions that if people were more involved in Facebook, there might be less terrorism in the world? Mark Andreessen, who started Mosaic, in their attempts to get it be a part of the political campaigns. Andreessen, of course, supported Mitt Romney in the most recent presidential campaign.
Right, and Zuckerberg is now bankrolling an organization called Ford US, which is acting as a lobby group for the tech industry. And I've actually recently written an in-depth article about these guys. The intentions are good, but they've made a lot of missteps. It's sort of the stuff of novices. But I think in general, the worlds of Washington and the worlds of Silicon Valley are coming closer together, and there's going to be a lot of mistakes along the way. But in general, that's a healthier thing for society.
Do you think that Packer's depiction in his article that a lot of people in the Valley, and we're not talking necessarily about CEOs here, just general people in the Valley, have a mistrust of government because it moves so slow, it's so inflexible, and that notion of inflexibility in government is actually an interest on the part of techies to improve government, not to dismiss it?
Yeah, there's definitely that attitude. I'm not sure how widespread it is. You can't say it penetrates 100% of the entrepreneurs and investors in the Valley, but it's definitely prevalent. Some people are trying to work with government. Some people are trying to disrupt it. But as usual, it's messy and it's not easy to understand. And I think that Packer, while correctly identifying the problem, just oversimplifies it a bit.
Packer describes how he grew up in that area, went to high school there. Do you think he's a bit jealous that he didn't cash in on some of this? He went into journalism like an idiot?
Well, as anyone who's in journalism will tell you, they think it's the best profession in the world, and they wouldn't trade it in. So I wouldn't say that he's jealous, no.
That's your story, and you're going to stick by it. We're talking with Hamish McKenzie, who's a reporter for Pando Daily, an organ of record, journalistically covers the tech industry and Silicon Valley. What do you think is an indication of the political sophistication in the Valley? Who has this right?
An indication of the political sophistication? Who has the right?
Who's doing politics right? Who's on the right track here?
Well, there's one group called Engine Advocacy, which is a more low-profile group that represents the interests of the startup community, and they are trying to sort of act as a bridge between Washington and Silicon Valley. There's the group Forward.us, which is bankrolled by Mark Zuckerberg. They're a little bit more brash and out there and have got a lot more money, and they've upset a lot of people and alienated a lot of people, but they are trying to pull it back together. But then there are a bunch of startups and investing groups that are trying to do right by the world and not just be inward focused and not just trying to solve the problems of rich people, but also trying to do things that will help society at large.
Do you think Washington operatives look at Silicon Valley as people who are easily manipulated, that it's great to have Zuckerberg front for your cause, and Zuckerberg may not be aware of some of the details of how Washington operates, particularly on K Street?
I think there are probably some people in Washington that look at Silicon Valley and see money and see an opportunity to get some ads bought, and that there will be some degree of manipulation going on. But people in the Valley are becoming increasingly sophisticated. They're not 100% of the way there yet, but it's getting better.
The Forward, before we go, the FWD group that you just mentioned is mostly focused on immigration right now. Any sense it will broaden its focus and deal with other issues?
Yeah, they're concentrating on immigration now until they say a bill gets passed. And then I imagine they're going to move on to other issues, including education.
Education in what sense?
I think advocating for education improvements for people working in science, technology, engineering, and math, which are the key subject areas that are important to Silicon Valley because there is a shortage of engineers.
Immigration and STEM education, two starting issues for Silicon Valley political operatives. Hamish McKenzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hamish McKenzie is a reporter for Pando Daily, reacting to the article in The New Yorker by George Packer, which describes Silicon Valley as a political bubble. What do you think? Do you come from the Valley? Do you come from the tech industry? We'd love to hear your view on all of this. 877-8MY-TAKE or post a comment at takeaway.org. And is U2 music to your ears? Maybe Bono's philanthropy isn't. Stay with us. U2. The name of a Cold War era spy plane. It's a beautiful day. It's also something of an embrace, a call for togetherness. You too. Such is the built-in ambiguity of the rock sensation U2 and its frontman Bono.
Having, you know, Bob Dylan or John Lennon or Bob Marley later, you know, whispering words of dissent and encouragement into my ear, a simple idea that the world can be changed and that you must change too.
Bono's mystique comes from his own carefully cultivated ambiguity. Is he the sunglassed sex symbol in black leather or the messiah of pop do-gooders in black Africa?
Chris Anderson asked me if I could put the last 25 years of anti-poverty campaigning into 10 minutes for TED. I said, Chris, that would take a miracle. He said, Bono, wouldn't that be a good use of your messianic complex?
Certainly, Bono is having the time of his life holding on to the global spotlight as an aging rock and roll activist, philanthropist, and pal of former Presidents Bush and Clinton. Over in Dublin, Ireland, though, where Bono is a local boy and a much less revered figure, people say with perhaps a bit of jealousy that Bono is better known as a tax dodger and an egomaniac who delivers more coolness to billionaires than he delivers resources to the poor. Dublin-based journalist Harry Brown explores this critical premise in his new book about Bono, titled The Frontman. Brown says Bono's belief in himself may far exceed what he has managed to accomplish on the ground in Africa.
There's never really been a celebrity at his level who, on the one hand, is a very successful popular culture figure, and on the other hand, is regularly mentioned as a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. So he is bringing this, if you like, this marketing of philanthropy onto a new level. And in some of the particular ways that he operates in terms of making the operations of the rich world in the poor world appear beneficial, they're really quite, the consequences are quite terrible. So, for instance, the question of tax avoidance, which everyone has been talking about, Bono doesn't only practice tax avoidance, as most people know, in relation to his investments in Ireland. He actually preaches it, so that when controversy came out about U2's tax affairs, he said, hey, tax avoidance essentially is how Ireland got to its prosperity. Everyone knows there are clever people in the government and in the revenue who created a financial architecture that prospered the entire nation. Now, by the time he said that in 2009, that very same financial architecture, it was clear, had beggared not only the entire nation of Ireland, but it had actually beggared the world. The financial architecture of Ireland, in other words, has been at the center of the financial crisis over the last 5 years, and it costs Africa tens of billions of dollars every year. And that's the really important thing. On the one hand, you have Bono praising the American government and praising companies who throw some money at Africa, and of course some of it does good. But on the other hand, encouraging policies in terms of trade policies, in terms of encouragement of foreign-owned investment in Africa, the encouragement of genetically modified crops, and the encouragement of tax avoidance that actually cost African governments in the billions.
When Bono shows up at Davos, is there a difference between someone like him and someone like Warren Buffett or some of the corporate interests that are represented at the World Economic Forum?
Well, Bono, in some respects, is their employee, even though he's very wealthy himself. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates pay for Bono's campaign organization, One. And Bono works very hard to continue to be the kind of symbol of, if you like, the soft nature of the powerful. And so when he's at Davos, he's there almost like a mascot rather than like a peer, I think.
Does Bono know he's a frontman in your view, or does he believe he's playing the lead singer for this philanthropic rock show that he's been putting on for the last couple decades?
I think that if he didn't believe that at some level, it would be very hard for him to continue to do it. I mean, he often jokes himself about the scale of his ego and what it takes to be the front man in a rock band, what it takes to want those spotlights, those sounds, those thousands of people all converging on the person of yourself. And I'm sure that an element of that same buzz is what comes down to him when he's at Davos, when he's on television, and indeed even when he's traveling in the developing world.
As an author, journalist, and economic critic, who do you think Bono helps to get off the hook in terms of international criticism? What corporations, what institutions, what public figures associating with Bono, what benefit do they get?
Well, that's a great question, and I think there's been a series of them. I'm not sure that Bono is perhaps delivering quite as much as he would have done 10 years ago. So, for instance, when at the time leading up to the Iraq War, when the Bush administration essentially turned to Bono to work on AIDS funding for Africa and got a lot of really good publicity out of the association with Bono, Bono and Bush walking together in the Rose Garden, you had a situation where in the State of Union address in 2003, President Bush said that he was going to deliver money for AIDS in Africa, and in the next paragraph he said that he was going to be attacking Iraq. So there was a real direct link between what Bono was encouraging Bush to do in Africa and to portray that as a humanitarian act, and to portray in turn the invasion of Iraq as a similarly humanitarian act. But there have been others. I mean, at the moment you've got Monsanto in Africa, and Bono is part of a coalition that's encouraging foreign-owned agriculture and chemical agriculture in Africa. You've got the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which of course most people regard as largely benign, but Bono essentially portrays Bill Gates as the personification of enlightenment, just as he portrays, say, Facebook as the vanguard of the global revolution. And he's got this obsession with sort of data and the idea that data are the key to unlocking the problems of poverty. It's actually a kind of a techno-utopianism, which is in itself, I think, deeply flawed. And indeed, many of the statistics that Bono brings forward in order to put forward his case that he and others like him are saving Africa, I think, are also deeply flawed. And I've written about that as well.
Can you listen to U2 music without thinking about these economic critiques anymore, Harry Brown?
Oh, God, yes, I can. Yeah, and I like quite a lot of U2 music. I was never a huge fan, but I also have never been a hater, as it were. And I think that U2 have done some beautiful songs. I can certainly listen to the likes of One or Bullet the Blue Sky and not think, what a shame about this guy. I think you can separate the man and the art, and that's what I've tried to do here.
Harry Brown, journalist and author of The Frontman, Bono, In the Name of Power. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Film director Joss Whedon, we learned earlier this hour, finds relief from Hollywood blockbusters in William Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, his latest movie. And many of you have favorite places in Big Bill's body of work.
My name is Barbara from Birmingham, Michigan, and my favorite Shakespeare quote is, "And when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and the face of heaven will be so fine that all the world will be in love with night." Ah, I love that.
This is Michael Yates from Seattle, Washington. My favorite Shakespeare quote is from the play Macbeth. Lady Macbeth says, "Will all great Neptune's oceans wash this blood clean from my hand?"
Hamlet's a favorite for many of you. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And the even more famous, "What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable in action, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god." Shakespeare's bit of irony there. He goes on to say in the very next line that man is just the quintessence of dust. We always want to hear more Shakespeare or anything else from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Love struck Romeo, seen the streets a serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. You find the street light, steps out of the shade, says something like, "You and me, babe, how about it?" Juliet says, "Hey, it's Romeo. You nearly gave me a heart attack."
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.